Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour for December 2nd, 2021. Wow, what a group of topics to cover tonight, and something that just became visible, so to speak, Comet Leonard. This is going to be a December comet coming up in a few days, and C2021A1 is the designation. Comet Leonard was discovered by this guy, Leonard is his name. Last name, and it was discovered at a institutional telescope on what appears to be a standard search. So I don't quite agree with using public funded equipment and then giving the accreditation to a person. I don't agree with that. But anyway, that's what they did. That's not the story. This comet is going to be visible to the naked eye in the month of December. So there, I'm going to have some dates here for you to keep an eye out, literally. And this comet is going to come extremely close to Venus, and you're going to have a ringside. This is a front row seat in the theater of the sky. And I'll be talking about the dates when this is going to happen, etc. And so 12/18, it's going to be 4.2 million kilometers, or around 2.6 million miles from Venus. This is on the 18th of December. And I don't have its closest approach to the sun date, but that's not important. That's not something that really is significant. This comet is going to be pretty far from the sun, relatively close to the orbit of Venus. So being the closest position to the sun is not necessary for this discussion. I could give it, but it's not wouldn't have a lot of meaning. But here's the deal: 2.6 million miles is around 10 lunar distances. So that is the distance from Earth to the Moon. It's around a 250,000 miles. But the distance that this comet will come close to Venus will be around 10 times that. So really close electrically. Gravitationally, not significant, because this comet is most likely very small. Does not have the appearance of being a big comet like Hale-Bopp. Hale-Bopp was visible to the naked eye for 6 years, which is just totally unheard of in modern comet science, so to speak. But this comet is going to start to be visible in the next couple of days, and there is information online on how to see it. But on the 18th of December, this baby is going to cruise right by Venus. I mean, nose to nose. So we might have a spectacular pre-Christmas. This is 1 week before Christmas. If you forget the date, just think, okay, 7 days before Christmas, and there you go. And Venus is up very brilliant in the western sky right now. And so you can see it. The Venus will be also up in the western sky at this time, so very visible. And if this comet connects electrically to Venus, which I think it's going to, I don't see how it could not, because the coma, just imagine this, the coma, which is is basically the visible part. This is where the dust is visible in the electric field. It's the combined electric field of the sun and the comet nucleus. And Venus will be very much enshrouded in that coma, which means it will be able to electrically connect to the nucleus of the comet. This is huge, because would not this be fantastic to see Venus go comet? This means that this comet is already breaching the solar capacitor. It's already discharging the solar capacitor. It probably has an electrical length of a couple, I would say conservatively 50 million miles, 50 million, possibly 100 million miles. And so Venus is already with an active tail. This is huge, because every time Earth comes around, in fact, this is also going to happen. Let me look at my notes here. On the 8th of January is our next inferior conjunction with Venus. Venus passes between Earth and the Sun. So the 18th is only 12 days plus 8, 20 days, and Venus could be literally going comet it will be calming down by the 8th of January, but it will still have an accentuated comet tail. And that means that we will be immersed in this. And what happens when we're immersed in the comet tail of Venus? It happens every cycle of Venus, every time. It's like 540 days approximately, the period between Earth's next approximate inferior conjunction with Venus. But this is very interesting timing. Now the new moon. Not to add any drama to the picture, but the new moon is January 12th with the new moon passing on the 14th of January. Now, the new moon passing, as I explain in my books, which I hope, I'm sure all of you have read my books, but if you've forgotten, the new moon passing is where the new moon is right between Earth and the sun. It's blocking the solar wind. It's absorbing the solar wind, and basically Earth is resting back in the comet tail of the moon, and then about 2 days later, 1.5 to 2 days later, the moon is moving out of that connecting line between Earth and the sun, and all of a sudden the solar wind comes pounding into Earth, and the only protection we have is our plasma magnetic field, which is only out about 35,000 miles to the sunward side. So this comes pounding in, that contracts. And that's an accentuated time for strong weather. But we now have the issue of Venus connecting in 4 days earlier. This is incredible timing. Incredible timing. And I also looked at the planet Mercury. And Mercury does not come around for an inferior conjunction until the 23rd. So that's with Earth. So anyway, the end result is that Mercury is probably not going to have a big effect. If it were coming around anywhere like around the 8th to the 12th, that would be a different story, because that would be another significant factor relative to Earth connecting with Venus and this comet. Now, this comet, I have to mention, is not aligning with Earth. It's coming very close to Venus on the 18th of December, and that will kick up the tail of Venus, that will accentuate the tail of Venus, which still should be accentuated by the time Earth and Venus connect on the 8th of January. Okay, so you may want to replay this a few times. Of course, the archives are on my webpage, jmccsci.com, and so you might want to come back and listen to this, because there's a bit of detail here and some numbers. But that's also a time, the inferior conjunction of Venus on that 8th of January, is a time when Earth has increased viral activity. In other words, the viruses that are formed in the comet tail of Venus then come into Earth. What they do is they gestate for a period of time in pigs. So that's sometimes called the swine flu, the Chinese flu, because they have a lot of pigs in China and a lot of chickens. And so then it mutates a little bit. It then is transposed into chickens, and then it's easier transmuted from chickens to humans. And sometimes you heard that it's called the bird flu, the swine flu, the Chinese flu, the Russian flu, and it implies that those doggone Chinese are giving us viruses. No, it's relative to the inferior conjunction of Venus. And this goes back to the 1200s. When the Chinese literally were the ones who first noticed this effect has been published in the medical journals, peer-reviewed medical journals talk about this. If you go to your doctor, he's probably not going to know anything about it. Most doctors today are prescription writers. They're not doctors. And so anyway, excuse me for the little hiatus there about doctors, but it's really true. Okay, so anyway, I will be covering this topic a little bit more, but let me be very specific. Around the 15th of December, which is just, you know, around the corner, a couple, you know, a week away, a little more than, well, today's December 2nd. So, you know, a little less than 2 weeks away. I would say around the 15th, start watching the western sky, start watching Venus, and you're going to be able to see this comet creeping in, coming in close to Venus. And would not this be, I mean, wouldn't this be the Christmas show of the century, of the millennium, if all of a sudden the whole world could look up at Venus and see this naked eye comet, Comet Leonard, coming in and connecting and enlarging. Now the comet's going to enlarge too when it starts connecting with Venus, because Venus already has an electric field. Venus is physically bigger, but it's in a circular orbit. So you have these, if you understand my work, the way the discharge of the solar capacitor works and the way comets work, then you will find that the comet should expand, enlarge, and become more visible as it approaches Venus. And it's going to be short-lived. This passage is going to be wham. It's going to go by very quickly. And let me stretch this a little bit. Now, this comet nucleus, I believe, is pretty small. This is not a big comet. It's probably bigger than most comet nuclei, but it's probably in the 10 to 20 mile diameter range, somewhere about there. That's a guess. But at any rate, so it's not a big comet nucleus, so it's not going to have gravitational effects on Venus, even though it's coming pretty fast. The effects will be electrical. And as I say, what if Venus went comet? Now, I have seen Venus go comet before. Go comet, what does that mean? It turns into a visible comet. In other words, it starts developing a comet tail that's visible. You can see the comet tail of Venus with the infrared signature. You can also see the X-ray signature on the sunward side of Venus, where the electron beam is coming in from the sun. It's discharging the solar capacitor also. Venus does not have a magnetic field, so you don't get the auroras situation like you have on Earth, where the incoming charged particles from the sun, the solar wind, come into the Earth's poles because of our magnetic field, and they follow those field lines into the north and the south pole. But on Venus, there is no magnetic field to speak of, very faint, if at all. And so the discharge, electron discharge on the sunward side hits Venus directly, causing Bremsstrahlung X-rays, the same thing that happens on comets. And of course, Venus was a comet thousands of years ago. It's recorded by the ancients. That's what Velikovsky was talking about, and he was absolutely correct, in spite of the pomposity of Carl Sagan. No, Velikovsky was 100% right. Carl Sagan was 100% wrong. And modern science continues this charade. I found it comical in the article that was talking, the article that I saw, was talking about Comet Leonard. It said that comets become active when they're inside the 5 AU, 5 astronomical unit, that's the distance from Earth to the Sun, 5 astronomical units from the Sun, or about the orbit of Jupiter. Well, right now, today, there are 4 comets that are way out beyond the orbit of even Saturn and Neptune and Uranus. And these comets are visible, very visible to telescopes. If you had an amateur telescope, you would easily be able to tune in and see all of these. So how do these comets become magically active when they're that far away from the sun, when the theory of dirty snowball theory says that they can only be active within the orbit of Jupiter? Well, it's goofy science that they're presenting to you, the public. So anyway, back to this, around the 15th, put this on your calendar, start looking at Venus in the western sky at night, start observing this comet, and it's going to come in very fast, and on the 18th, it's going to come zipping by Venus, and I think we could see a light show here, folks. We could see Venus go comet, we could see the comet expand, we could see potentially an electrical discharge, and this is what the ancients saw. This is what Velikovsky talked about. This is what the ancients talk about in the Colbrun, the big sky monsters, which were comets. That was their term for them because they didn't understand. Fighting in the sky, and multiple big comets at the time in those days. And then my estimation was also that when the books of the Colbrun were originally written, these were from the library of Joseph of Arimathea, but these were ancient books that he had in his collection. But anyway, they talked about the comets doing war, basically connecting physically and electrically, and that's what Velikovsky was talking about. The ancients saw when Venus came in, they saw the discharges between Jupiter and Venus. They saw the electrical discharges between Venus and Mars, and they experienced the discharges between Venus and Earth. Remember Moses, the Venus connection was going on at the time when Moses was leading the Israelites, the true Israelites, out of Egypt, and the pillar of fire that reached up into the heavens. They talk about that. They talk about the parting of the Red Sea. Those were the tidal waves moving back and forth on this shallow body of water as the gravitational wave of the comet came by, and Venus was close. It had a gravitational effect, and that's what I'm saying. This comet Leonard is not going to have a gravitational effect on Venus, but Venus did have a gravitational effect on Earth. There was mountain building. The people talk about it. The rain of brimstone and fire. And also this, how about Moses when he went up to Mount Sinai, to the peak of the mountain? They talk about the winds. They talk about the burning bush. Remember the burning bush that was consumed by, was burning, but it did not consume? That's an electrical fire. That's an electrical discharge because that tree was sticking up and collecting the electrical energy coming down from above, from the comet connection. So there were all of these electrical connections going on. Remember the stone was burned. The Ten Commandments were burned into stone. What did that? Another electrical discharge. And when he came down and they wandered in the desert for the next 40 years, their way was lit by they called it the light stick in the sky. There were various terms. But that was Venus. That was Venus, the comet, very bright in the sky. The Mayans talk about this. All of the ancient Chinese talk about this. The Tibetans, the American Southwest natives, the Incas in Peru talk about it. The pre-descendants of the Aztecs passed that down to them, and on and on and on. So anyway, but we could get a mini taste of this on the 18th of December. Wouldn't it be grand? Wouldn't it be wonderful? Wouldn't it be amazing? This would be the best Christmas present that anybody could give to me, would be to see the whole world looking up at Venus, watching that comet expand, watching it connecting electrically with Venus, and the whole world going, that ain't no dirty snowball. Carl Sagan rolling over in his grave, wherever he is. Wouldn't that be the best Christmas present that God could give to me? You know, it would just be incredible. Absolutely incredible. So, but there's no guarantee. There's no guarantee that it will expand. It's coming close. It's going to be very quick. It's going to be a very quick passage. But I think there's going to be some activity. It's only 10 lunar distances. And as I said, that means that Venus will be well within inside the comet, the coma. That's the visible part of the comet. The nucleus, only being 10, 20 miles across, is not going to be a factor. It's not going to come close, not going to crash into Venus. But the electrical connection could make Venus go comet. And wouldn't that be wonderful to see this comet coming in, Venus going literally comet, visible comet, and just blow the astronomical community out of the water once and for all? Wouldn't it be wonderful to see all these astronomers just pick up their bags and quit? Go home and say, gee, McCanny was right. Everything we're doing is wrong. I'm going to quit. And probably a lot of them are really old. They could take retirement anyway. Okay, so anyway, enough fantasizing about this comet, but I think we have a good chance here of seeing this baby go comet. See Venus go comet, see the comet expand, the electrical connection between the two. I have another topic tonight dealing with comets, and that is about diamonds from comets. And this is something, if you look in my work, the Diamond Principle, I believe I talk about it in my Calculate Primes book. I believe I talk about it. And it's probably in some of the other books also, how the diamonds are made on the sunward side of comets when the electrical discharge comes in and hits the carbon. The carbon is the key, the carbon in the electrical discharge. And the reason I'm bringing this up, because diamonds are in the news because a big, big, big diamond was just found. In fact, the biggest diamond I think ever found in history was just recently found. And of course, what they say is the standard pat argument that it was formed under high pressure down deep in the earth and comes up through volcanic veins to reach the surface of the earth. That's the standard story. But if you think about it, that doesn't make any sense at all. Because how could softer ground and how could all this carbon accumulate down deep in the ground, and then all of a sudden this softer material creates so much pressure that the diamond forms? Well, it's pretty ridiculous. It's pretty ridiculous. Softer things cannot put pressure on harder things to make them harder. It doesn't work that way. It's the other way around, excuse me. But anyway, I want to play this little clip, and I'm hoping that you can hear this, because I'll do some critique of this in a second. But this is a clip from a video explaining the supposed origin of diamonds.
How are diamonds made? For decades, diamonds have been linked to romance and marriage, but how are they made? They start out not as coal, but as a form of carbon, the building block for all life on Earth. But to become a diamond, carbon undergoes an incredible transformation under very extreme conditions. Naturally occurring diamonds formed deep in the Earth between 1 billion and 3 billion years ago, and geologists say the recipe went something like this. Step 1. Bury carbon dioxide in Earth's mantle, about 100 miles underground. Step 2. Apply heat to around 2,200 degrees Fahrenheit. Step 3. Add incredible pressure, about 725,000 pounds per square inch. And finally, step 4, quickly rush towards Earth's surface to cool. Ancient volcanic eruptions billions of years ago are thought to be responsible for transporting most of the diamonds found today. All that sounds hard to replicate, but diamonds can also be made in the laboratory. In one method, tiny anvils squeeze down on graphite as intense electricity zaps it, producing gem-quality diamonds in just a few days.
Okay, boys and girls, grandmas and grandpas, moms and pops, and baby, everybody. Now, you just heard, this is, by the way, from livescience.com. And it said about 20 days ago, it didn't really give a date, but it said about 20 days ago this was posted, embedded in an article about this major league diamond that was discovered. So now let's kind of review this, because this would constitute what one might call the standard method or the standard story about diamonds and where diamonds might form. And now I found it comical at the very end when they were duplicating this process in the laboratory, and she goes, and then a big intense blast of electricity, and voila, you got diamonds. And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute, honey. Excuse me, where in this story of geologists saying how diamonds form deep in the ground and under pressure and tremendous heat millions of years ago, I mean, who could argue with that? Who could say it's right and who could say it's wrong? Millions of years ago, there was nobody around to test that theory. And that's what science is, just la-la land, lollipops and roses. Oh, isn't it great? And you just take this carbon dioxide and you put it in the ground and a little temperature and pressure. How did all the carbon dioxide get rid of the oxygen, first of all? Because there's no oxygen in diamonds. So all of that oxygen would have to be displaced somehow. And then you'd have to get all the carbon atoms together in a small area. And then you would have to get this extreme amount of pressure around it. And as I said before, how do you get the pressure by softer things onto the diamond, which is the harder thing, and then it magically pops up out of the ground and cools off, and you got a diamond. But the little story that's missing, of course, when they try and reproduce this in a laboratory, they're making diamonds, is the electric part. Where's the electricity zapperoo down in the ground? It's just like, wait a minute, boys and girls, grandmas and grandpas, anybody with half a brain, this story doesn't add up. And anyway, the way they do make diamonds, by the way, you do not need tremendous pressure. you do need the electricity. And so I suspect that they're doing a process that the diamonds are actually being made by the electricity, not by the tremendous pressure. And in fact, vast fields of diamonds have been discovered literally around other stars, in orbit around other stars. And diamond has a very characteristic spectrum, so you can tell today that's a diamond from its spectrum. And also that you find this phenomenon on Earth. For example, the mastodons that are discovered, for example, in the embedded in the riverbeds up in Alaska, for example. So they died. There was a major flood, and then they were washed down into this ravine where the river now is. And the top side of the point is that the top side of the mastodon, the bones, are embedded with microdiamonds. Microdiamonds. And so how did the microdiamonds get into the top layer of the mastodons and there's none on the bottom side? So these things came from outer space, unless you want to believe that the clouds were raining diamonds, and I don't think anybody out there is going to believe that story. No, they came from outer space. So diamonds do form in outer space. We see them. They are observed. But how do they form? And that's something I talk about in my books, and these are actually done commercially also. You take a vacuum chamber, you bring it down to a 10 to the minus 7 torr or something like that, a low pressure, and extremely low pressure. You vaporize carbon, the building block of diamond. And today when you see diamonds, if you buy a diamond that's formed in nature, it typically has defects in it. It has fissures. It has very characteristic. So if you find, like, for example, the big diamonds that are in the crown jewels of the Queen of England, for example, or any of the other naturally occurring gems, they have defects, and a gemologist would be able to look at that gem and say, yes, that's the true one. And if somebody tried to duplicate it and replace it, they would be able to tell, because you cannot duplicate those fissures, those imperfections that are in a diamond. And it's very characteristic. So at any rate, but you can make a perfect diamond in a laboratory, as the woman was saying. But the thing that she didn't, you know, the little unbalance of the equation of the logic here of what the geologists are saying happened in the ground was the zaparoo of electricity. Where do you get this big discharge of electricity down in the ground? Well, you don't, because the ground is grounded. It's conductive. You're not going to build up big charges in the ground. It's conductive. You know, it's, excuse me, boys and girls, but at any rate, be that as it may. So the way you do this, as I said, you take a vacuum chamber, you vaporize carbon, just carbon. That's all you need to make a diamond. And then you bring in an electric current. And the formative process, there is pressure required, but what happens is that the diamond, the carbon structure builds what amounts to a buckyball. A Buckminster Fuller studied the structures, and the geodesic dome is one of his, it's not an invention, it's an observation of nature, that this is the way nature builds the carbon structures. And so anyway, that's the one thing that happens. And these are extremely, extremely strong. And then the diamond forms inside the bucky structure. The diamond, the best term we have is a geodesic dome type of structure of carbon inside the diamond forms. And this all happens with an electric current. That is how the diamonds form in outer space on the nose side of comets. And that's why you see them in belts in orbit around a star, because a giant comet was in orbit around that star and left this trail of diamonds. And so anyway, that'll be something. I'm sure there's big diamonds out in our solar system floating around, something that would dwarf the Queen's crown jewels. They're out in outer space, and people, there might be techniques for finding them someday. They're going to be hard to find. They're going to be very rare, but they're out there. And the one thing you could do is you could go into the streamers of comets, into the debris fields of comets that are known, and you could potentially find diamonds there. because they are being produced on that nose side of the comet. Okay, now switching gears again, I've had a couple comet stories here. Here's a recommendation, and I'm kind of, I don't know how what else to call it, but you will see more and more now, there will be arrests, and I've seen a couple in the last week even, of people, of parents being arrested. The ones I saw were primarily women, moms, at a school where they were complaining and becoming vocal about critical race theory, about wearing masks, about the treatment of students during COVID, and, you know, on and on and on. I don't know what all the complaints, they probably had multiple complaints, probably about the literature relative to pedophilia that they're forcing down the kids' throats at the public school, and the list goes on. And I could think of about 50 things that you would want to complain about if you went to the school board in today's school systems. I mean, excuse me, I don't want to even go there. But my point is, why are the parents confronting the school board that is a corrupt bunch of degenerate people that are, running the schools, that have worked their way into the school systems and have turned the schools into, something you wouldn't even recognize. Certainly not an educational institution. It has nothing to do with the benefit of the students. It's to the benefit of the people who work there and make a lot of money off the school system. So why would you go and argue with people? There's an old expression that says, don't argue with an idiot lest you look like one. And that, I think, the perfect case. So my recommendation to parents is you vote with your dollars. Just take your kids out of the school. And when they have lower population, they get less money, and they're, like any business, their profit margin is pretty low. They're not going to be able to pay their teachers. The teachers are going to leave, and it won't be any school anymore. So that's how you do it. It would be like if there was some problem with some store in town, and the people in the town didn't like it, you just stop going to that store. The store would go out of business. That'd be the end of it. End of story. So you vote with your dollars, you vote with your spending. Most states have the ability to send vouchers to the parents so they can send their kids to some other school and get them out of these public school systems. But I can think of 50 reasons why you should not, absolutely not, send your kid to a public school. And in a lot of cases, private schools. But the switch towards private education and homeschooling has been enormous. I've talked about this on previous shows. I have an education supplemental package. I call it science supplemental package, but it's really, in general, teaching people about this garbage material they're pawning off on kids and parents in the public school system. But the way they get you coming and going is with accreditation. So even if you homeschool your kids, there's a list of books that you have to read and pass tests on to get accredited education. And that's where they got you, because that's where the garbage is. That's where the false information is. So what my education program does is it educates the parents first and then the students about the garbage that they're teaching you. And so to try and fend this off, and bring another dimension to education. My program is not accredited. I would never even think about it, having it as an accredited program, because the whole purpose is to expose the accredited program. Okay, so enough of that, but don't go and fight with the school board. Don't go get arrested. Don't get vocal. Leave. You know, don't get mad. You know, get even. As the expression. And how do you get even? Take your kids out of school. When the kids aren't in the school, they get less money. Once they're down to 60 or 55% of their population, they're going to go broke. They can't afford to pay the school board. The fat people that sit on the school board and make decisions that are just bizarre, you know, they have no authority to do what they're doing, turning the school into a prison. So just get out of there. Take your... Don't send your kids to a public school, period. Get them out of there. And if somebody got arrested going in to argue with the school board, I'd say, well, you deserve it. If you're so stupid as to go in and argue with people that don't have a brain, then shame on you. Just take your kids out. That's the answer. That's the solution. And just in the middle here, kind of the bottom of the hour, I'm going to just throw a little pitch in here. And as you're looking at the season of giving, as they call it, in other words, the season of buying stuff for everybody, take a look at my webpage. You can get a 10% discount on any of my water filter stuff. And the education package is, I think it's like 25% off Christmas sale. So anyway, there's a lot of big savings there. But give people the gift that will keep on giving. And that's like a water filter. They're already on sale. Everything on the water filter page, there's a, I think about a 5% discount. And then you can get an extra 10% off by using the coupon code JMCC, my initials, JMCC. You get another 10% off. So go there. And I suggest the MR5 whole house water filter. The biggest problem, the biggest source of toxins in your life is in the daily shower. Your skin is the biggest organ on your body. It's the biggest absorbing organ in your body, much bigger than your stomach, much bigger than your liver or kidneys. And that the toxins go right in, they go direct drive right into your bloodstream. And then also breathing in the vapor, the toxic vapor in the water from the shower, and you're getting a dose of this every day, and it accumulates over time. So get that out of your water. The MR5 whole house water filter is a point of entry, so you filter the water where it comes into the house. So the hot water, the cold water, all of the water in the house is filtered. And here's another little fun fact. You know all that lint that's in your dryer when you dry your clothes? Where do you think that comes from? Do you think your clothes are getting building up this dirt? No, that's your clothes coming apart because of chlorine in the water. When you wash your water in city water, when you wash your clothes in city water, it's got chlorine, and that's ripping your clothes apart. That's why after two or three times washing them in the washing machine, they look like Skid Row. I hate to say it, but they're coming apart, and all that lint in your dryer is your clothes literally coming apart, and that's because of chlorine in your water. So get it out of your water. So when you do your clothes, you're actually washing your clothes and they'll look nice for much, much longer. You got to get that chlorine out of there. So anyway, the whole house water filter is for your health, for your, you can take bottled water. And I tell people this, start the family taking bottled water from your tap with your own filtered water. And in a year, if you do that, you'll probably pay for the MR5 whole house water filter in less than a year. It's for under $2,000, and that includes the plumber to come out and put it in. You hire your own plumber. We help the plumber, and you have clean water. Okay, enough of that. Webpage, jmccsci.com. That's the main page. You can find the education package there, and also jmccwaterfilters.com, where the water filter stuff, all there, you know, and replacement filter elements. Also, my make your own water filter where you buy your own containers, food grade plastic containers, and it comes with a spigot, beautiful stainless steel spigot, and you make your own filter for travel, for the cabin, for emergency, have it in the closet in case the electricity goes out and you have no water. At least you can filter your water using my new HI filter technology. Okay, enough of that. So go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. and jmccwaterfilters.com. Okay, so let's go back to February 1st, 2003. Where am I? I happen to be in Texas that day. I'm on my way to the International UFO Congress to give a talk. The purpose of my talk is to discuss electric highways to the stars using electromagnetic propulsion systems and for space travel. And so the whole point is that stop using chemical rockets and all of the hardware that goes with it. And so anyway, it's early morning. I'm driving through Texas. I have gone straight south on I-35W, and I'm heading west now in Texas. I'm going west and going out to Laughlin, Nevada. But I'm in Texas. I just made that turn. And all of a sudden, I stop. I go into a gas station. And there on the monitor, all of the news is about the space shuttle coming in and breaking up. And I'm literally in the middle of the debris field that's occurring at that moment. The space shuttle had disintegrated. There was a problem with the space shuttle in that the apparently a piece of foam came off, a structural piece of foam came off the space shuttle, hit the left wing and damaged the underside of the wing, the hydraulics and other things. So this thing was going to come in. There was no way it was going to land properly. It broke up in the upper atmosphere. One point that I've made about this and the Columbia accident where the thing blew up as it was going up into outer space, you know, remember with the teacher on board and all of that, the whole countryside of kids watching it. But the point is that they never made the human-occupied part of the space shuttle. They never made it so it would just, like, could be blasted out of there and become a reentry capsule all of its own. And either one of these, with a parachute, would have saved the lives of 14 astronauts, because all they needed was a parachute. And in the case of the Columbia, where it was going up, the space capsule with the human beings in it actually blasted out the front side of the space shuttle and came down as an individual entity. And they free-falled for like minutes, falling till they hit the ocean and all died. All they needed was a parachute, NASA. Excuse me. But anyway, I wanted to, this topic of the space shuttle coming in, the accident over Texas, the second space shuttle accident. I was in Texas on that day in the middle of the debris field as the pieces of the shuttle were coming down on my way to Laughlin, Nevada, the International UFO Congress, to give a talk about how that technology, the space shuttle rocket technology, was not the way to go into space. I mean, talk about timing. And of course, through many incidents in my life, I've been in a place, you know, certainly not planned. I certainly didn't plan on being in the middle of the debris field as the debris was coming down on my way to give a talk about exactly why that isn't the way to go into space. And remember, though, that I had been giving this same discussion in inside military meetings to high-level NASA people and to the high-level the physics groups at Los Alamos National Laboratory, etc., that clearly knew my work regarding electromagnetic propulsion systems. But it never came about. And that's because they keep the public stupid. That's what the space shuttle program, that's what the space station program is. It's something visible. That's what the little rovers on Mars thing is all about. Oh, now they got a little helicopter roving around Mars. Oh, goodness. And I saw an article where they're finding fossils on Mars, and they're going, oops. Yeah, oops. They're fake fossils. They're not real. They just look like fossils. They're finding life on Mars and claiming it's false alarms. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. Anyway, I just wanted to mention that because since August, I've been giving talks on my show about the electric highways to the stars. And I happen to be, this topic of the space shuttle accident came up this week on another avenue of my endeavors. And I thought I wanted to repeat that now because I think that's an apropos closing to my entire lecture series on electric highways to the stars, that particular event. And as I said, I certainly didn't plan on being there. I just happened to be there at the time going to make a public statement. And you can see the video, Electric Highways to the Stars, in my DVD set. It's on the hard disc DVDs that are sent out by mail. You can order on my webpage. It's part of the disc number one, DVD number one and two set. They're sold together. And both of the UFO Congress lectures are on there, and one of them being Electric Highways to the Stars. So you can see me as a much younger person at that particular conference. And that's where a lot of you will, if you see a picture of me on the internet, you'll see a picture of me standing. I'm in a suit. I'm giving a lecture, obviously. Behind me on the wall is a because of the slides being shown, is a picture of the Wardenclyffe Tesla Tower. And with I'm standing there pointing at it and giving a lecture. So anyway, that's possibly one of the more commonly seen photos of me if you go online someplace and look at, for photos of me. And by the way, I'm a bit heavier then. I'm a bit balding. All my hair has grown back. And I'm a lot less, I'm a lot lighter, and I'm in much better health conditions right now than I was at that time. And why is that? Well, lots of reasons, but one of them is because I'm drinking really good mineralized water. And so that's another thing. People go, oh, they want to drink distilled water. Terrible, terrible idea. The people that I know that drink distilled water also mix it with a mineral complex, typically Himalayan salt or something else that has good mineral balance in it. They're not simply drinking distilled water. Okay, anyway, about the last 13 minutes of the show here, I'm going to discuss, and I'm not going to have time to cover all of this, it's an article that appeared in a magazine. It's called Earth's Eight Biggest Mysteries. And if you look at standard science, of course, they can't answer these because none of it makes any sense. The biggest mystery on planet Earth, in terms of geology, these are mainly geological mysteries, but why does Earth have all this water? Because according to the standard story, Earth was formed 4.5 billion years ago, and of course that date is about as bogus a scientific fun fact as you could ever find. There's nothing at all realistic about that 4.5 billion years ago story. I mean, they picked up some rocks on Earth, and they said, oh, we, by a radiology test, they determined some concentrations based on certain assumptions of certain radioactive elements, and then they go, okay, that means the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. They've stuck that date in the history books, in the science books, and then it's like the old country western song, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. And it's the kind of a comical country western song, right? But when I talk about NASA sticking to their story, that's what I always refer to. And that's why you should go listen to that song. It's called That's My Story and I'm Sticking to It. And think about NASA while you're listening to it. Anyway, back to the Earth and its water. Where did all the water come from on Earth? And so the problem with the standard story of the Earth forming from a collapsing cloud of junk, gas, dust, whatever, is that the heat of formation is tremendous, tremendous, tremendous. And so anyway, any volatiles such as water or any other chemicals, carbon dioxide, any other volatiles would be baked off. They would go off into space and never be there. So the question is, where did the water come from? So then they go, well, maybe comets hit the Earth and contributed water. But if you go out and visit a comet, there's no water on the surface of all these little comets out there. The big ones have some water, but that's because they have enough gravitational field to attract the material in the water that's formed in the comet tail, because it's coming into the comet itself. And so Earth, acting as a comet, discharging the solar capacitor over eons and eons, billions of years, as Carl Sagan would say, would be the reason we have water. We still have water coming into Earth right now. Water on Mars is occurring all the time. It's building up water. And the reason it forms at the poles of Mars, the reason they're observing it, this is recently formed water because Mars lost all its oceans and water and atmosphere a number of thousands of years ago. It was a blue planet. And so anyway, Earth got its, so it's not a mystery. So the number one mystery that geologists cannot solve is easily solved when you look at my model of how the solar system works. Earth, in its cometary stage, had a tremendous atmosphere. Look at Venus. Venus is a very young planet, a number of thousands of years old. It already has a tremendous atmosphere. And so why does it have a tremendous atmosphere? That's because it's part of the formative process of how comets work. and it's not due to millions of little comets hitting it and dropping off the water. That story doesn't make any sense either, because even if you had a little comet with some water on inside or on the surface, and it hit Earth, all of that water would vaporize. It would go off into outer space and never come back. Simple. So it's not even an explanation. And where did those comets get the water? Oh, they can't answer that either. Oh, dear me. Anyway, so the biggest number one mystery on the planet is not a mystery. Okay, let's see. What's in the core of the Earth? Well, that's not a mystery either, because we know there's a magnetic field, and so the only place a chunk of matter that dense and hard could get a magnetic field is if it were in the molten core of a star, or in a planet like, say, Jupiter or something like that, and for some reason that thing collided with something else and just blew it all to smithereens, and this piece of material came into the region, the solar capacitor of our sun, and started accumulating matter on top of it. And there were two epochs, because the Earth has two layers of core. The innermost core, which is very dense, which has a magnetic field, that magnetic field was solidified in that material in some other celestial body, not in Earth, because it's characteristically out of place. It's too large for it to have formed in Earth itself. And then the second core is much larger, not as dense, and then the entire Earth is built up on that. But Earth has many, 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 many layers, thousands and thousands of layers, epochs where the material is building up. And so if you went down probably 5,000 feet, you would find life down there. And that's why you find oil that's deep down in the Earth, because the surface of the Earth at that time was accumulating oil when it passed through the tail of large comets, which was common. It's a common event. And when the Earth loads up with oil, it really loads up. I mean, it's like the Noah's flood of oil coming in. And that's why the Earth, our current layer of Earth, has a lot of surface oil. When oil was first discovered in the Mideast a long time ago, around 1200 AD, it was in pools laying around on the surface of the desert. And they started using it and figuring out how to break it down into its various components and using it for warfare, etc., and making big balls that would burn. They could throw them over the wall into a city that they were attacking, or other forms, or into lamp oil for utility, etc. So all of these things were understood very early in the discovery of oil. But where did the oil come from? It came from outside planet Earth, in Earth passing through comet tails. And so this layering Earth was going on. And so it's not abiotic oil that forms down deep in Earth. It's the fact that Earth has been layering up, and those layers down there were exposed and had oil, surface oil at the time, and that got trapped in the Earth. That's where it came from. So where did the Earth's core come from? Well, it was the original comet core of planet Earth. Where did the moon come from? Mystery number three. Well, maybe the moon was here before Earth. But when you look at the idea that this, they keep trying to talk about, well, something crashed into Earth, knocked a big chunk of it out, and there's the moon. Well, that doesn't make any sense either, because the Earth's structure doesn't show something that's the size of the moon being gouged out of it. There's no structural entity on Earth that is that size. It just doesn't, and the moon doesn't show this either. But when you understand that the moon and Earth were built up from comet activity, the plasma discharge type of comet, then these became trapped in each other's orbit. And eventually the moon was probably much farther away from Earth when it first was trapped into our gravitational field, and it's slowly working its way in. But they were captured. And it could be that the moon was here long before Earth was here, that Earth came as the secondary, even though it's larger. Okay, where did life come from? Okay, this is a good one. And of course, they can't understand this because they're basing it on evolution. And the idea that plant life just magically evolved out of nothingness And here's the issue. Here is the basic issue with all of this. Now, we know that the nucleotides, which are the small molecular chains that build up the building blocks of life and of DNA, etc., are formed in outer space. And so here's the difference between my structure of how all of this began, and that is there is a grand design. This is all part of a design. And so when people talk about evolution, they're talking about communist atheist evolution. In other words, these things evolved all on their own without any design. It was just random. And that's the big difference, because when you look at DNA, if you look at a horse or a monkey or a person or a dog, you know, in the physical structure of the animals are the same. Two nostrils, two eyes, one mouth, teeth, you know, a stomach, a liver, a kidney, you know, digestive tract, lungs, ears, all of the structure is the same. What's different is the DNA which produces these, and there's a million varieties and variations, and we would expect to find this in other places in the universe, which is infinite in extent, it's infinite in time, and we can't understand these things because our brain is very limited. I've talked about this, how man does not understand, has to use tricks like induction to understand infinity just in a number line. Okay, so that's number four. I could talk for hours and hours on that topic. Where did the oxygen come from, the O2 in the atmosphere? The same thing. We are in an oxygen field in outer space, and Earth is a comet, is drawing on in this material all the time. And oxygen is one of the main components out there, and we have hydrogen. So when the oxygen comes into Earth as part of the discharge of the solar capacitor, then, in fact, we're building up the oxygen, we're building up the carbons, we're building up the carbon dioxide, we're building up oil, we're building up material, carbon-based material, and all of the other elements in the solar system. Earth has a lot of iron in it because we came close to the sun, where the solar environment is rich in iron. And we also got labels with some pretty big impacts throughout the history that created the uprising of the iron along the Big Iron Ranges, say in northern Minnesota. What caused the Cambrian explosion of life? And so anyway, I'm running out of time here. The other question is, when did plate tectonics start? Well, plate tectonics never started. It's a bogus theory. It doesn't work. It doesn't explain anything about geology. And will we ever be able to predict earthquakes? No, we won't, because there's too many factors that we don't know about. I'm out of time. I'll be talking more about these topics in the future. Remember, my webpage, jmccsci.com, jmccwaterfilters.com. We'll talk to you next week. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.